My name is Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And this is Edge Cases, a podcast about mostly Apple-related software development and German mistranslation. This is episode 18. We're recording on Saturday, September 15th, 2012. And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Obsolescence.
Obsolescence. All righty. Is that that topic come about because you were worried that, you know, that I missed one podcast? Yeah.
That I'm obsolete, of course.
You're obsolete. Right. Well, yeah, like we were talking on offline. I mean, I have all the infrastructure set up now to deal with, you know, recording the call and doing all the filtering and massaging of it and everything. And so actually, you know, we really basically, we no longer need you for your technical expertise. We just need you for your public-facing personality.
For my massive Twitter following. That's it.
Well, actually, yeah. That's true.
I put massive in air quotes there.
Well, I mean, how many Twitter followers do you have? You have like 5,000, something like that? It's
something
a lot.
Like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I just tweeted about this recently that it's like kind of silly for me to be retweeting something for someone who has like, you know, factor of 10 more followers than I do. But I do it anyway.
You see, one of my favorite parts of my blog is the things I've been wrong about section. And as soon as Jalcut fixes Mars Edgeworth Tumblr again, hint, hint. A little cross podcast swipe there. He said, no more episodes of Core Tuition. You bang that one out, right? But, one of the things I was wrong about is, retweet support on Twitter. I thought it was pretty bad. I was one of the guys who, you know, who has like a mute filter in Habari for RTs in the early days. And, having Twitter having real support for retweets means things like when you retweet everyone follows, like say Gruber, I don't see that duplicate tweet. So retweet right. away, you know, retweet away, do that good night.
Oh, that's true. That's true that it doesn't. That's true. I've noticed that in the clients now, you don't see things more than once if you've seen it. And actually they coalesce them. So it'll say, you know, by so-and-so and retweeted by you.
Right.
So yeah, you're right. Yeah, right. It doesn't do any harm, but it's not doing any good either.
You're right. Is it? You're kind of like the you're being overshadowed by the sun or something. I don't know.
Like that. Yes. So before we get started, I'd just like to give a thank you out to Uli Kirscher, who was my guest co-host for last week. And so yeah. So the plan this week, as we want to keep it such that the numbering system is consistent. So Wolf has the odd numbered episodes and I have the even numbered episodes. And after this episode, which is episode 18, which would normally be mine, but now Wolf will do a topic, and then 19, he will also do a topic, and then we'll be back on the regular schedule.
Right. The way I put it is that I'm doing penance for taking vacation. Yeah. So two episodes in a row.
Indeed. So then what was I doing when I did two episodes in a row?
You did two? Oh, yeah, I guess you kind of did. Oh, pre-penance. We're all guilty.
Yes, indeed. All right. So I think that's it for me. So take it away.
Okay. So I'd like to talk about obsolescence and both in terms of software and hardware. So, Andrew, how long do you usually keep around a development machine?
Like personal machines. So for me, obviously, personal machines are not I don't differentiate. There's personal machines, which are also development machines. And I've kept my machines around certainly a number of years, certainly more than 3 and possibly like 5 plus. I've kept around the machines that I'm buying myself.
By development machine, I mean like basically the machine you're currently developing on. Because I have like old PowerPC machines and stuff like that that are stuck in the closet that I use for like testing in my programs afterwards. But they're not my active development machine. I'm talking pretty much about your personal machine.
Right. So I make sure that the machine that I'm using for my personal regular use, my main machine, is powerful enough to run Xcode and to build the projects that I need to build. So yeah, so my personal machine does have to be a developer machine. And again, yeah, it can still last pretty long. I don't need a top of the line machine from, you know, always a year ago to build the things that I need to build. I just mainly need to make sure that it has enough RAM in it. That's actually probably more important even than processor speed.
Yeah, it's RAM is definitely used to be my bottleneck. I used to max, you know, order the machines max out all the time. But I've discovered with SSDs now that it's less of an issue because VM works so much better with SSDs. So my current machine is just a 4 GB MacBook Air, and I was really worried about, you know, getting a new machine with a 4 GB ceiling, and it's been fine.
Okay.
Yeah. So the reason why I brought this up is that, so it sounds like maybe you're running maybe 3 years before you upgrade your machines.
Or more. I don't know the exact numbers. I tend to keep them a decent amount of time. It's probably over 3. It's probably really more like 4 or 5, but I don't know for certain.
Okay, that's interesting. I was knowing you like I do, I would have guessed you're more on a kind of a 2-year, maybe 3-year cycle. So that's longer than I would have suspected.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. You seem like a trendy guy. You always have the new shoes and the flashy shirts.
Sure, yeah, that's me.
Oh, wait, I'm confusing you with that other guy. Oh, sorry.
That other Andrew.
It's awkward. Wait,
yeah, the other.
But, yeah, so yeah, I used to be one of those guys that would, like, get a new machine every year or whatever. And,
really?
Yeah.
You would get a new machine every?
Yeah, pretty much every year. I figure, you know, I'm obviously, it's my life, right? So I'm spending hours and hours of each day in front of it, and faster compiles are good, and so this would always get the latest, greatest. And
so for our listeners, yes, the Edge Cases co-hosts do still need to get to know each other a little bit.
It's,
the things we learn.
Andrew, right? Andrew, yeah.
Yeah, right. Andrew?
Can I just call you Drew for short?
No.
Okay.
Sorry, go on.
Yes. So, but what's interesting is that I just got this MacBook Air beginning of the year, and I got it only for a trip. And before that, my primary machine was, I'll use quotes here, MacBook Pro in parentheses 17-inch early 2008. So that's what, 5 years old if I could do math or something like that, 4 years old. So so like you, I was running a 4-year-old machine, and I don't know what it was about this 17-inch. Machine, but you know, every year that a new machine would come out, I would look at it like, I don't need it, and that was new for me, and so it felt like I didn't need to get the latest. That everything I had was fine, and a couple years ago I put SSD in it, and that totally livened it up, and so I didn't feel really memory bound. I told you that VM works better with an SSD. And so I just kept on working with the machine I had, and it was just fantastic. It was it's a great machine. It's still working to this day, and it started me thinking about, so what happens, you know, so this machine, even though I'm not actively using it right now, it's totally workable and totally functions. And so I'm start to wonder about what's the deal with these older machines? And obviously, as developers, we like the latest and greatest. Well, maybe not you and me, I guess, anymore. But it's like, it seems to me that there's every year, Apple and all the computer technology industry pumps out new latest greatest, and it's not like the olden days where it's like where you would go from 128K to 512K. It's the differences between the generations of machines have definitely slowed down, that the machines are not super appreciably faster. And so I'm struck by, actually fired up my old 400 megahertz Pismo, which is a 400 megahertz G3 PowerBook. I had to correct myself there. I almost said MacBook.
You're right.
For the longest time, I would always call MacBooks PowerBooks. Yeah. Apparently, I've swapped that key in my hash in my brain, but now it's failing me going the other way.
Well, so how old was that at Pismo? It sounds, what, 7 years, 10 years old now? Something like that?
Wasn't that like in the 90s, late 90s?
Wow.
Yeah,
so, yeah, maybe.
Yeah. It's probably 12 years old, something around there. But, you know, I fired it up, and I was surprised because it actually had apparently past me had upgraded to the very latest version that could still support, which was like something like 10.4.11. And I was surprised that this really old machine could run 10.4.
Yeah.
And you know, 10.4 doesn't feel that far away to me, because that's obviously when Apple introduced core data, and I kind of, and that's to me a big milestone in terms of how you program Mac apps. So it felt to me like it's almost like a modern environment in this really old machine. And the machine, I mean, you know, Apple design, of course. This machine, even though it's old, it's black and it's beautiful. It feels very thick compared to today's Airs and all that, but it definitely looks good. And the screen was amazingly good. And then also, I've fired up an old iMac for my mother, and I was surprised. And this was actually the original Intel iMac. So how many years that is, I don't know. But that machine was surprisingly sprightly. I was actually surprised how fast it was when I was using it. And granted, it didn't have any junk loaded up on there, no apps, nothing there. But it was like, I expected, because I had a hard drive in there, that it'd be like, oh, it's going to feel like molasses to me. But it actually felt fast with the hard drive that came bundled with it, which was actually pretty small, but it was very fast.
Hard drives aren't completely obsolete just yet.
Right, especially for the archiving stuff. So I talked around and asked my friends about, so what do you do with your old hardware? And it seems to me that sounds like most people either sell it, but the majority actually, this seems to like this kind of pass along to friends and family. Is that in your apartment in San Francisco, do you just have like half of it walled off with old Apple boxes with all the hardware through the ages, or do you actually like pass it around to your family?
Well, remember, I'm in San Francisco, and so my apartment is, you know, the size of a, you know, the porch of some other, you know, places that I've seen that people own.
Do you sleep on a box of Apple boxes?
So I don't have the space to be holding on to a whole bunch of old boxes or old machines. So actually, one of the first things I did when I left Apple and had a little bit of time to myself was I went through the extra steps it would take to find the places that would take old machines for recycling. Hmm. So what I had done actually was I had a couple of different machines for a while, and I'm not sure why anymore. Some of them were sort of semi-obsolete and some of them weren't. And I narrowed myself down to a single machine, a laptop, and just got rid of everything else. So that took some doing, but yes, just, you know, recycled them all. And that was a little new for me, because I had held onto a bunch of old machines for a while in the past. But now it's just the only computer in this apartment is my own personal laptop.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So the giving away to recycling or charities, that's also common. But it kind of leads to my second point, is that if you do, I guess when did this recycling program, did they actually tear apart the machines and try to recycle the materials, or did they just like pass them on to schools or something, or do you know?
Yeah. From my understanding, I've read a bunch of different things about recycling efforts. And some of the things I've read say that when you give away your machine with the expectation that it can be used in a school, that you might actually be putting more of a burden onto schools by expecting them to be able to take old machines like that,
right?
Because they have a whole bunch of different, they then have a whole bunch of different machines which require different levels of maintenance and different software and different everything. So that's actually not a, one thing I've heard is that that's not a great solution for old machines. So no, the thing that I gave it to, they were going to either tear it down themselves or knew the right people to sort of, you know, take them apart to get the materials from it. And they did charge money for it, except for the laptops that I gave in, because the laptops had some sort of city or state subsidy for that work. But it was definitely, it was not, you know, sort of, oh, this is me helping you by giving you the machine. It was more, okay, I'm going to pay you for a service to take these machines and do the right thing with them.
Okay. So that's interesting. The entire, and which I obviously I've set you up very well for this, because that leads into my next point, that you say that these older machines, they can definitely be a support burden. And when you think of it, why are they a support burden? And I guess it tends to be two things that come to mind is that it's hard to get components for them, and that the computer industry is still moving along fast enough between like dumping ATA drives or SATA drives and dumping CD-ROMs and just going with SSDs. There's enough churn in the industry and advancement that I feel that it's really that's fine with me. But there seems to be like a market or economic issue here where old hardware is like used as a proxy for identifying the low-end market segment. So there's so typically what you want to do is when you have a product is that you have people who can barely afford your product and there are people who can totally afford your product. In fact, would be happily give you more money. So what you want to do is you want to segment your market. So that's why Apple has low price iPads and then they'll double the RAM and it costs them $20, but then they'll charge $100 for that upgrade. And that's how Apple will segment their market. So obviously you can pay more because you're not hurting. So, although arguably is it, if anyone's buying Apple, are you really hurting? But that's probably another talk. And so one of the things that kind of came to mind when I was working with these machines that felt amazingly powerful today and is that they couldn't run the latest software. And so the hardware-wise, yeah, I understand that. I can get behind it. But from the software side of things, it strikes me that the reason why the software support isn't there is because the software industry, and that by that I pretty much mean us and the people who pay us, is that the money isn't there. We'll say it straight out that people with old hardware don't buy new software, and we repeat that to ourselves. But I wonder actually how true that is. I mean, imagine if you could get a $200 Mac that you could keep running for much longer because you can buy $20 apps for it, or even $10 apps. So, do you have any thoughts on this idea about this proxy for identifying low-end market segments?
Well, I do know from my time at Apple, they did certainly the impression that Apple gives to the outside world is that it really is very much a future-oriented company. Mm-hmm. It doesn't spend a lot of its resources or time on supporting old hardware or old OSs or anything like that. It supports them to a degree. It supports a certain amount of them, but it's not aggressive. It's certainly not aggressive in the way Microsoft is for its support for very old versions of the OS. And I can say that external impression was certainly matched by the internal attitudes of the people I work with, of the whole company. And so it wasn't an act. It really was that the mindset was, don't spend a lot of time on the past. Mm-hmm. And there were arguments for that. Pretty much every time that they made a decision like that, well, maybe not, but certainly some of the times, my impression from internally was not that they said, well, we're not going to do this out of malice or carelessness or whatever, just heedlessness. It was always pretty much backed up by the facts. So if they were going to stop supporting a certain segment of the market, it was because that segment was no longer the largest segment of that market, that they were still doing the most good that they could do by focusing their effort on this piece rather than on this other piece. And it's also true that it was always a cost-benefit calculation in that supporting older models, older versions of the OS, PowerPC, whatever, that always costs something. There's always, if you're doing twice as much work to support the last third of the market or the last fourth or fifth of the market, then you have to decide for yourself, well, is that worth it? So, and that's the one thing that people don't tend to remember too much when they think about these things is just how much extra work it would be, how much it slows things down to do that. Of course, Apple today, it's a little harder for Apple to cry poverty just now for those sorts of things. But I can guarantee you that they will not change in that regard. Well, they won't change unless there's sort of a pretty big sea change in their management, in that they really think of this as something that they do well, that is something that makes them better as a company when they are more aggressive about stopping support for things. And so if they stop doing that, it's because that philosophy will have changed, that they will have stopped thinking that for one reason or another. And I think they will both internally and externally, it would be perceived as losing their edge. So that's, I'm sorry, what was the original question?
something that we can rewind later and insert what we're talking about. Sure. But along those lines, if you install 10.5 now, I believe to this day, you will get the latest Safari. I think you get whatever the latest Safari is. 6.1 or something? 5.1 or something?
I've heard that relatively recently. Yeah, I was actually been surprised that Safari and iTunes, I think, go back far longer than you would think they would.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And here, this will bug me unless I actually use the right Safari version number here. Apparently it is 6. Yeah, okay. So you can tell I'm a Chrome guy. Okay, so this is actually a good example of Apple bending over backwards to ship newer software for this older hardware. And in a related vein, and for very different reasons, I know that, so Android has this problem where you buy your Android phone and you'll get it with an old operating system. Like there'll be, Ice Cream Sandwich, whatever version Ice Cream Sandwich is, and Ice Cream Sandwich version 0.1 has already been shipping for a few months, but of course your phone doesn't have it. And quite often that there's no feasible upgrade path. Or if there is an upgrade path, it tends to be very nerdy. It's not one of these things where on the iPhone it's just like, it says, hey, there's an update. Why don't you update? It might be something much more geeky to go through that most people won't go through. And so because of this kind of environment they have, there's this facility, and I've heard the name a couple times, but it's fallen out of my head. But it's basically they will ship new APIs in jar files or whatever the Java knockoff that Android runs is. Or you could tell my ignorance coming through here, but. So you can use a new API. So imagine you were on 10.3 and Apple ships core data, and like they could put core data in a jar, and now you could use core data on a 10.3 box. That's kind of roughly what's going on, to apply the Mac world to it. And so it's a bad situation for Android phones, but it allows apps to ship with these compatibility libraries that basically allow them to use modern APIs on older software and older hardware. So in that way, it's both the Safari side of the coin and the Android side of the coin. They're both this idea of like, you can bring new software and new functionality to people who've already have bought this hardware and using the hardware. And you can bring the present back into the past. And like you said, there's obviously a cost to this. I mean, all these dancing around doesn't come for free. But I wonder, is it really the kind of the burden that we like to tell ourselves?
Well, I think certainly from my experience, there's also a mental component. And it's funny, I keep coming back to this, but did I say this in another podcast or something other? But the fact being that there really is very little artifice in what you get from Apple in a lot of ways, not in every way, but in a lot of ways. Like the mindset was so forward looking that it would really have been, even if it weren't like a real financial burden, even if it would just have been maybe, an intern or whatever, or a low level engineer. Okay. Just have that one person do the maintenance and then we'll be fine. It's not even going to cost us very much. But just in terms of morale, I think if they suddenly turned it around and said, okay, now, for example, just pulling a wild example out of the blue, Xcode's going to support the last three operating systems instead of just the current one and the previous one, which actually even the latest, like Xcode 4.4, supporting both Mountain Lion and Lion.
Yeah,
that's a fairly huge step. And actually they did that in the last one too. They did that with Lion and Snow Leopard as well. And people...
Yeah, you can't tell me that a bunch of Xcode wouldn't be much happier, Porsche auto layout and the likes.
Yeah. Well.
Okay.
Really? When they pack so much stuff in, is there that much room for stuff to move around? But.
Okay.
But the okay. So even you know for actually even just two OSs are a lot. It's probably it was a big deal when they did that. Mm-hmm. So if you said okay now two more after that okay now you're going to support Lion for the next 5 years, mm-hmm. even if it didn't cost that much, I think it would feel like a burden to the people designing it, because as you said, it's exactly the way you said. Now we can't use the new features without there being a drag to it. Like, okay, if we're going to use auto layout, we've got to set up the UI such that now you have two different UIs, mm-hmm. one that uses auto layout and one that doesn't, or just don't use auto layout for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think Apple in particular, the mindset just is not such that they say, okay, we won't use our own cool stuff for five more years. That's just anathema to them. They would, people throwing themselves out of, you know, four-story infinite loop windows if they could, you know, I think there's a mindset aspect to it, at least as much as a physical cost, financial cost.
Yeah, that's a good point. But again, along with the idea of being able to port stuff in the future. I mean, obviously Apple does not port the present into the past. Obviously, you know, macOS 10 and iOS is not designed with the idea that Apple could roll out basically new frameworks and new APIs and just ship them and they will be backwards compatible with older operating systems and older machines. That was never a priority. And you're right, that's part of the ethics and the value system there. And which for some reason, Android for the carrier reasons, has this. And obviously Apple's capable of it with entire WebKit thing and as you mentioned, iTunes. So, but again, yep. Those aren't really developer kind of tools, although you could argue web is a platform or whatever, but yeah. So it's, so yeah, I'm, so basically long story short, I agree with you.
No. We've got to argue about something. Come on, say you don't agree.
But I could move on to my topic. So that was kind of my hardware topic. So basically, this is kind of a touchy-feely thing, but it just something doesn't feel quite right to me, that we have these older machines that are quite capable, and yes, you can run into the ground until they just don't work no more. But it strikes me that we have like some sort of software sickness in the industry, where either for economic reasons or because of planned obsolescence or something, that for these machines that are very supportable, that we stop giving support to them. And it might just be because programmers are well paid and like to work on the newest machines, and newest machines are just enough incompatible that we don't care. But it's not all evil, right? Because if you look at the trend line of the cost of computers, like they have gotten, you know, every year they've gotten cheaper by a certain percentage. And so it's not like we're just like, you know, cranking the knob to give us more money. It's, you know, software and hardware is getting cheaper and less expensive and more accessible to people. So obviously the trend line is going in the right direction. But man, we just still have a lot of, I don't know how many like PowerPC Macs are out there, but man, they're just all obsolete, man. And it's kind of shocking that, you know, all those years of manufacturing those machines that still light up and work, like, they're not going to ever be able to run the latest software.
Well, did you see my tweet about all my PowerPC apps that I saw in my applications directory?
Right.
They're all dead.
Yeah.
Well, sorry if I'm hijacking things a little bit, but it does dovetail into some of the stuff we've talked about growth, in that we can't keep making more and more and more new computers every year and still have the old ones around or still have the old ones in drawers or whatever. That's not, you know, we have finite resources on this planet. And this idea of, you know, infinite growth, infinite new stuff, infinite whatever. At some point we've got to say, well, no, we're gonna build stuff that's gonna last for 20 years. Maybe. It just sounds so crazy compared to what we have now. But that would be the way to do it if you want to be sure that you don't run into these kinds of problems that you're talking about. But it just sounds crazy.
I had this vision of antiquing where you pick up a nice dresser from 1840 and your computer from year 2050.
Sure.
Okay, so I have a couple other topics on the about obsolescence. And but so quickly run through these. That's kind of the hardware aspect of obsolescence, and that's kind of obviously more tangible. But software obsolescence, which I kind of brought up, but there's really four aspects of it. There's executable, there's languages, and part of that is design, and then there are data formats. So when you look at like software executables, obviously, like Apple's king, and next also, right? Next went through the transition between 68K and what did they? They jumped to? They didn't. No, they definitely jumped to x86. But they also had PA RISC, right. And they had different architecture supports. All right. Of course, Apple went from 68K to PowerPC to Intel, and so a bunch of different, you know, ISA changes, instruction set architecture changes, and you know that's. Again, I know I was hoping that x86 would have died a long time ago, and maybe ARM's our chance to actually watch it die.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, that's, and to me, that's market dynamics, and that's pretty much unavoidable. And what's kind of worrying me is what Apple's stance towards things like emulators and virtualization systems. And this one I'm a little bit foggy about because I got this information this recently, and I haven't checked out to see whether it's true, but like Apple put in its license, end-user license, saying that you are not allowed to virtualize non-server versions of their operating system. So I believe they started putting that in 10.5, but maybe that wasn't even the 10.4 EULA. I'm sure you read that, Andrew, right? So you could tell me what was in there?
Yeah. Well, yes, I've memorized it, of course. Paragraph 34, subparagraph 5.
There you go. And VMware and Parallels and VirtualBox, they all stop you from trying to virtualize Mac OS X inside Mac OS X. And unless you're running the EULA-supported server version of Mac OS X, which is terrible and no one should use it. And so this is one of these, like, so the piece of foggy information that I'm not quite sure of, because I read it right before I went on vacation, was supposedly a VMware, the latest version of Fusion, allows you to run non-server Mac OS X in Mac OS X. So I don't know if Apple change the EULA and 10.8 for this or not, but if that's the case, and total thumbs up, it would be nice if they retroactively went and said, yes, you can virtualize 10.5 and 10.6 and 10.7 and all the rest.
Oh, yeah, that would be nice. No, I think I could be wrong too, but I believe from what I heard, this was actually a change in Lion. That Lion was the first one that they said, okay, now you can put this in a virtual machine.
Oh, that's good.
But again, I could be totally wrong too, but I don't think it was Mountain Lion. I think it was Lion.
Okay. Well, that'd be total thumbs up. So that's good. That I can understand, you know, the Apple lawyers being behind the curves in terms of not having any language at all, obviously, because it didn't really exist on the Mac before we had Intel. And then, you know, as virtualization came, it came popular with VMware and Parallels, like, oh, this, you know, standard lawyer thinks like, no. And then maybe later on, we can creak the door open. And so that sounds like maybe that's what happened, which is great. So that allows us to take this obsolete software and run in modern systems, which has its pros and cons. But I want to keep moving on and want to try to keep this a little bit short. So another thing about software obsolescence is that the languages we use to write software. So I don't know about you, but the first like real language I used in programming Mac was C. Did you begin with C?
C and C++, yes.
Okay. Oh, really? So you actually started with C++. C++ was later for me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you never was on the Pascal side of things?
Never did Pascal, no.
But at least did you have the inside Macintosh tomes that had the Pascal API listings?
I never had the inside Mac stuff.
I'm sorry, we have to end this podcast right here. I don't know who you are, Drew.
Well, I think most of it was available online by the time I was, you know.
Well, I guess I'm the gray hair. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so obviously C and Pascal and these languages, you know, function only, imperative only, not functional functions. And you came upon the scene when C++ was raging. So there was that, I don't know how long it was, maybe it felt like a decade. Maybe it was more, maybe it was less. But there was like the big time span where C++ was the language that you used.
Yep.
And with the good thing about C++ was that is that you could just leverage all your C code, because in most ways it's a superset of C. So you could take your I don't want to say obsolete software here, your obsolete code here, but let's say legacy code, and you could go ahead and bring it along to the future. And that's largely, you know, what Carbon was, right? It was that you could keep on modernizing this legacy software and add new modern features to it. So that's pretty well. And then, of course, you got Objective-C, which has much the same abilities of being able to leverage your old C code. And that's kind of because of the Unix heritage of Mac OS X. And, of course, then you have Java and C# and JavaScript and all the rest. So we definitely – so this is actually, I would say, a shining example of the industry. And it's shining in that we've advanced languages, right? You can definitely argue – I think no one can make the argument against that Objective-C does more than C does. I mean, well, I guess pretty much by definition, right, is a strict superset, or at least used to be. I don't know if that definition holds anymore. But so software, so we are shifting languages, we're doing a really good job of kind of taking this legacy software that we wrote and kind of bringing it along into the present and modernizing it as we go. And so I have to say that this is a thumbs up. The one downside I would say is that it almost feels like that someone needs to make the Apple argument of what they do in hardware type stuff. It's like, you know, that we need to cut the cord in order to make faster advancement into the future. That in many ways, these previous languages, and you know, obviously in my mind, in Objective-C, it feels like a boat anchor kind of like dragging behind us and really slowing things down. But overall, thumbs up. And so as part of the language, kind of as languages get higher level, like, for example, Objective-C, the objects are quote-unquote real objects, right? In C++, you go to compile, and your objects go away. All that's left is, if you're lucky, you get vtables. And with Objective-C, like, every object has and is a pointer right in it. And that, you know, that's obviously a little bit of overhead. But so that's, what, 4 bytes on a 32-bit system and 8 bytes in a 64-bit system. And that's a cost of doing business if you're going to have these real objects with dynamic dispatch and all that. But if you look at the original Macintosh, 128K of memory, right? So if you try to put typical Objective-C object is a pointer, it probably has a pointer to another object. It probably has a couple IVARs, something like that, in there. But let's just say, and then you have the malloc overhead, but let's say that each object takes maybe about 32 bytes of memory in the low case. That meant that the original Macintosh could only have dealt with 4,000 objects, right? 4,000 objects. That's it. That's not very many. You hit no VM system, right? So it's like that is a limitation of what your computer can think about. It can think about 4,000 things. And of course, the 128K didn't last that long, although arguably too long, but until the FatMac came out. But so the original 128K could think about 4,000 objects. And so then it sounds like maybe the 512K could maybe deal with 10,000 objects. But to me, this has been kind of an interesting metric in my mind in terms of how can we design software in terms of what can software even do? And obviously, if your problem set has to deal with 100,000 objects, there's no way the original Mac could have possibly dealt with it. Maybe you could roll your own VM system to swap off the 400K drive or something, but it's even that it was a very, very limited machine, and so that limited what the software could possibly do. And it also had, because objects, quote-unquote real objects, are expensive, you'd want to use something like C++, where you don't have pay that ISA tax. So you'd want to try to front load all your decisions. That way, you don't have the runtime overhead of having those decisions late binding. So as machines have gotten more capable, it actually has changed how we can design software. And I think if you look at the architecture of Cocoa versus Carbon, it's actually a pretty good trade-off. A good example of kind of API evolution. Obviously, they don't have very much to do with each other at all, but they're kind of products of their time. And if you just look at the Cocoa tech system about how you have all these interoperating, collaborating objects to draw lines of text, that's totally not something you could have done a few years ago, because that type of overhead would be way too expensive. You had to have, you know, all you could afford is jump statements and functions, because you got to keep that footprint low because the machines themselves didn't have the power. But now, because we have, you know, this we have more colors in our palette, we're able to design software in ways that are more robust and allow us to do more things. So, I mean, if you look at the Cocoa tech system, it's freaking amazing. I mean, it's basically a desktop publishing package in an object-oriented API. It's very impressive. The Carbon APIs never had that type of abilities. So that type of advancement of APIs is what is given to us by the advancement of the hardware.
Just to jump in for a second, I mean, the next APIs are actually pretty old,
right?
Really.
Oh yeah.
And in some ways, they still have some of the legacy baggage in them.
Oh, absolutely.
Simply because Apple hasn't excised it all. And in some ways, it's old has become new again, because, for example, they put a lot of effort into making sure that you only loaded the nibs that you had to load, because memory was more precious. And then, of course, that becomes useful again on the iPhone.
Right.
So, yeah, it's really sort of interesting. The OS X software stack is actually still fairly antiquated from a technological standpoint, but it's done them quite a bit of good for the iPhone.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I was actually thinking that while I was saying it. That although the next step APIs of Yore were different in terms of, you know, this was even before we had things like auto release pools, and you didn't have collection classes and all that. So, you know, if you passed around a list of things with the original next APIs, that was a C array. You'd use malloc and free to deal with those. And of course, the next machines got more powerful, and you could actually have things like NS array and NS mutable array.
Yeah.
Okay. And for the final point in our obsolescence talk is data formats. And I have to give a thumbs up to industry again, because I think pretty much that, the bad old days of completely proprietary binary formats where you'd, you know, open up your IDE and you type out structs in your C or C++ headers, and that's what you would write to disk, and that's what with your persistence mechanism. Those days are pretty much over. Pretty much now, people are using, like, obviously packages are popular on Mac OS X, which are these directories that have flat files in them. So if you want to put your JPEGs next to some block of text, you can actually put a JPEG file and a .txt file right next to each other and wrap them up as if they're a single file. That seems to be more popular now to, at least, like, Pages and stuff like that, and Keynote, to kind of put those in a zip file, so that way it tends to be more atomic. Although that was when, like, Apple was kind of waffling with the Mobile Me days. I don't know if they even care anymore.
But I think there's still zip files. I think that's...
Oh, yeah, there's still zip files. Yeah. I don't know if that... It sounded like they had, like, atomicity issues with uploading and downloading those packages.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. So they're just like, okay, we're going to use zip files now. And yep. I don't know if that still holds now that they don't seem to care about MobileMe. Well, they definitely don't care about MobileMe, but maybe it helps with the iCloud story. I don't know. But so obviously, we have plists that are XML. And we have, for the heavy storage, we tend to be using SQLite. So this is, and of course, Core Data makes it very easy. Instead of, like, write out your structs in your C header file, and that's what's going to be written to disk, now we actually have a visual editor of our entities that we hook up, and we can explain to our our development environment at a very high level, that we have these entities, they have a one-to-one or one-to-many, and that can, and if you delete this one, then we cascade delete this other one. That's really high level, and that's really great. So this is a great example of software moving ahead, and the bad old days of binary formats have pretty much been left behind. And what's good from the obsolescence and the legacy standpoint here is that this stuff is far more flexible and easier to deal with 20 years from now than the crazy binary formats we used to deal with in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Those are, you know, I've had to deal with a lot of the stuff. I had to reverse them to or to get them to work with Mono software. And the great thing is that everything I mentioned there, all that is open source. You know, SQLite is open source. Zip file format is open source. Obviously, XML packages are self-describing JPEGs. So we've
Core Data open source.
obviously not the framework, but you can pop open MOMs and MOMDs, right? And
what do you think? I mean, do you think Core Data file formats are easy to reverse engineer?
Well, obviously, SQLite ones, right?
Yeah,
SQLite ones, definitely. The binary plist, trickier, but that actually has, you know, someone on GitHub has reversed it. I would say that's probably the biggest throwback to the bad old 90s. But, and of course, then you have the XML one, which is actually really great for development. So I would say, on the whole, yes, Core Data is a great story.
Okay.
So it's from a kind of a archaeology standpoint, it's the Apple device you buy in 2050 is probably going to be able to open up all the data we're creating today without any problems. That's where I don't know if we could have said that about the stuff, all the documents we've generated in the 90s.
So. Well, what's interesting is that Apple hasn't even deprecated the binary serialization APIs that they have. I mean, they've got APIs that will take an object send that right out.
The NS Coder stuff, right?
And, you know, and that stuff really sucks for future-proofing your stuff because, you know, it's very much closely tied with exactly what your object does, what it's called, and all sorts of other little details that you don't necessarily want to have, commit yourself to for a data format. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it seems like most people don't wind up using that these days, which is good.
Yeah, I have had contracts where I've had to reverse those file formats, those NS Coder serialized things, and for the most part, it's not so bad. So obviously you don't have the original classes, but what you do is you just say, okay, you know, you write your own classes, and you see what tries to get deserialized, and you kind of fill in the blanks,
right. Mm-hmm.
And that's how you do it, and it pretty much works. And it's definitely slow going. It definitely is a reverse engineering type of thing you do, which is always non-optimal, but it's still a lot better than a lot of these C++ level persistent type stuff that we had to do in the past. So that's pretty much my rant about hardware and software obsolescence and the thumbs up and thumbs down, all that. And anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that'll cover it for now. It is sort of funny that you know, you talk about, because your theme has been in the past how Apple is sort of behind in its language design and its how it thinks about computer languages.
Right.
And yet now, this is really kind of a big caveat of an episode where we say, well, okay, they're still behind in all that. That has its downsides. But, you know, the upside is that you can be more, you can handle obsolescence better.
Mm-hmm.
The more you keep any aspect of your system sort of more backwards, sort of less straining the future edge of things, the more you're capable of keeping fewer of requiring fewer things to be obsolete. That makes sense?
I think so.
And so that, you know, is hardware and software. Like what would happen with Apple if they said, yeah, we're not going to push on our hardware so much anymore. That would allow you to, you know, to use older cables, you know, for example, like they've just done with the iPhone.
Right.
They made the new cable style. And then, you know, if they just said, well, no, we're not going to do that. Or we're going to use, you know, micro USB, whatever it's called, instead. So it's interesting. It's interesting. It seems like a lot of it's a balancing act, and I think it's good for us to be kind of pointing out where they are in that balance at any one particular time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So that's it. So, all right. So please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes, and more. And you can also find us individually on Twitter, myself, A. Pontius, that's A-P-O-N-T-I-O-U-S, and Wolf, his last name, Wrench, that's the word rent, R-E-N-T, plus Z, plus S-C-H. So we'll see you next time.